had they approached me the day I saw my mother in the passenger seat. She was not translucent, or shimmering, or milky white. She was as solid to me as the guy who took my parking ticket minutes later when I pulled out of the garage. It was as if I'd photoshopped a memory of my mother into the here and now, a trick of mechanics, like those videos where the dead Nat King Cole sings with his daughter. No question about it. My mother was as real as the steering wheel under my shaking hands. But doubt has a way of blooming like fireweed. Once it takes hold, it's nearly impossible to eradicate. It's been years since a spirit has come to me for help. If a skeptic said to me right now, "Who do you think you're kidding?" I suppose I'd say, "Not you." And certainly not me. The kid at the Genius Bar who was supposed to be helping me has the people skills of Marie Antoinette. She grunts as she turns on my ancient MacBook and lets her fingers tickle the keyboard. She doesn't make eye contact. "What's wrong?" she asks. For starters, I'm a professional psychic with no connection to the spirit world. I missed my last two rent payments. I stayed up till 3 a.m. last night watching a Dance Moms marathon. And the only way I could get into these pants today was by wearing Spanx. Oh, and my computer's broken. "When I try to print something," I say, "nothing happens." "What do you mean, nothing happens?" I stare at her. "What do people usually mean when they say that? Does your screen turn black? Does anything come out of the printer? Do you get an error message? Did you document anything?" I have a theory about Gen Y, these narcissistic 20-somethings. They don't want to wait their turn. They don't want to work their way up the ladder. They want what they want now. In fact, they're sure they deserve it. Young people like this, I believe, are soldiers who died in Vietnam and have been reincarnated. The timing's right, if you do the math. These kids are still pissed about getting killed in a war they didn't believe in. Being rude is just another way of saying, "Kiss my 25-year-old ass." "Hey, hey, LBJ," I say under my breath. "How many kids have you killed today?" She doesn't glance up. "Make love, not war," I add. The techie looks at me like I've lost my mind. "Do you have Tourette's?" "I'm a psychic. I know who you used to be." "Oh, Jesus Christ." "No, not him," I correct. Chances are, if she was killed in Vietnam in her past life, she was male. Spirit is genderless. In fact, some of the best mediums I've ever met are gay, and I think it's because they have that balance of masculine and feminine in them. But I digress. I once had a very famous client, a female R&B singer, who had died in a concentration camp in a previous existence. Her current ex was the SS soldier who had shot her back then, and her job in this life was to survive him. Unfortunately, in this existence, he was beating her up every time he got drunk, and I will bet you anything that, after she dies, she'll return in some other incarnation that crosses with his. That's all a human life is, really. A do-over. A chance to get it right. Or you'll be brought back to try again. The techie opens a new menu with a few keystrokes. "You have a backlog of print jobs," she says. And I wonder if she will judge me for printing out the Entertainment Weekly recap of The Real Housewives of New Jersey. "That could be the problem." She pushes some buttons. And suddenly, the screen goes black. "Huh," she murmurs, frowning. Even I know it is not good when your computer technician frowns. Suddenly, the store printer, on a table adjacent to us, hums to life. It starts spitting out pages at breakneck speed, covered from top to bottom with X's. The papers pile up, overflowing onto the floor as I rush to pick them up. I scan them, but they are gibberish, unintelligible. I count 10 pages, 20, 50. The techie's supervisor approaches her as she tries furiously to stop my computer from printing. What's the problem? One of the pages flies right from the paper feed into my hands. This page is covered with nonsense, too, except for one small rectangle in the center where the X's give way to hearts. The techie looks like she's going to burst into tears. I don't know how to fix it! In the middle of the string of hearts is the only recognizable word on the page. Jenna. Holy hell. I do, I say. There is nothing more frustrating than being given a sign and not knowing which way it points. That's how it feels when I go home, open myself up to the universe, and get served up a steaming hot bowl of nothing. In the past, Desmond or Lucinda or both of my spirit guides would have helped me interpret how the name of that kid glitching up my computer is connected to the spirit world. Paranormal experiences are just energy manifesting itself in some way, a flashlight flickering on when you haven't pressed the button, a vision during an electrical storm, your cell phone ringing, and no one on the other end of the line. A surge of energy pulsed through networks to give me a message. I just can't tell who sent it. I'm not too thrilled about contacting Jenna, since I'm pretty sure she hasn't forgiven me for leaving her at the steps of the police department. But I can't deny that there's something about that kid that makes me feel more genuinely psychic than I've felt in 7 years. What if Desmond and Lucinda sent me this as a test, to see how I'd react before they committed to being my spirit guides again? At any rate, I can't risk pissing off whoever sent me this sign, just in case my whole future depends on it. Fortunately, I have Jenna's contact information. That ledger I make new clients fill out when they come for a reading. I tell them it's in case a spirit comes to me with an urgent message, but in reality, it's so I can invite them to like my Facebook page. She has written down a cell phone number, so I call her. If this is supposed to be some kind of customer service survey, with one being total crap and five being the Ritz-Carlton of psychic experiences, I'll give you a 2. But only because you managed to find my mother's wallet. Without that, it's a -4. What kind of person abandons a 13-year-old alone in front of a police department? Honestly, if you think about it, I say, what better place to leave a 13-year-old? But then again, you're not the average 13-year-old, are you? Flattery will get you nowhere, Jenna says. What do you want, anyway? Someone on the other side seems to think I'm not done helping you. She is quiet for a second, letting this sink in. Who? Well, I admit, that part's a little fuzzy. You lied to me, Jenna accuses. My mother's dead? I didn't lie to you. I don't know that it's your mother. I don't even know that it's a woman. I just feel like I'm supposed to get in touch with you. How? I could tell her about the printer, but I don't want her to freak out. When a spirit wants to talk, it's like a hiccup. You can't not hiccup, even if you try. You can get rid of the hiccups, but that doesn't prevent them in the first place. You understand? What I don't tell her is that I used to get these messages so often, I got jaded, bored. I didn't know why people made a big deal out of it. It was just part of me. The same way I had pink hair and all my wisdom teeth. But that's the attitude you have when you don't realize that at any moment you might lose it. I'd kill for those psychic hiccups now. Okay, Jenna says. What do we do now? I don't know. I was thinking that maybe we should go back to that place where we found the wallet. You think there's more evidence? All of a sudden, in the background, I hear another voice. A male voice.
Evidence? He repeats. Who is that?
Serenity, Jenna says to me. There's someone I think you should meet. I may have lost my mojo, but that doesn't keep me from seeing, in a single glance, that Virgil Stanhope is going to be as useful to Jenna as screen doors on a submarine. He is distracted and dissipated, like a former high school football star who spent the past 20 years pickling his organs. "Serenity," Jenna says. "This is Virgil. He was the detective on duty the day my mother disappeared." He looks at my hand, extended, and shakes it perfunctorily.
"Jenna," he says, "come on, this is a waste of time."
"No stone left unturned," she insists. I plant myself squarely in front of Virgil. "Mr. Stanhope, in my career I've been called into dozens of crime scenes. I've been in places where I had to wear booties because there was brain matter on the floor. I've gone to homes where kids were abducted and led law enforcement officers to the woods where they were found." He raises a brow.
"Ever testified in court?"
My cheeks pinken. "No."
"Big surprise."
Jenna steps in front of him.
"If you two can't play together, there's going to be a timeout," she says, and she turns to me. "So what's the plan?"
"Plan? I don't have a plan. I am hoping that if I walk around this wasteland long enough, I'll have a flash of recognition. My first in 7 years." Suddenly, a man walks by, holding a cell phone.
"Did you see him?" I whisper.
Jenna and Virgil lock eyes and then look at me.
"Yes?"
"Oh." I watch the guy get into his Honda and drive away, still talking on his cell. I'm a little deflated to find out he's a living person. In a crowded hotel lobby, I used to see maybe 50 people, and half of them would be spirits. They weren't rattling chains or holding their severed heads, but rather talking on their cell phones or trying to hail a cab or taking a mint from the jar at the front of the restaurant. Ordinary stuff. Virgil rolls his eyes, and Jenna elbows him in the gut.
"Are spirits here right now?" she asks.
I glance around as if I might still see them.
"Probably. They can attach themselves to people, places, things, and they can move around, too. Free range. Like chickens," Virgil says. "Don't you think it's weird that with all the homicides I saw as a cop, never once did I see a ghost hanging around a dead body?"
"Not at all," I say. "Why would they want to reveal themselves to you when you were fighting so hard not to see them? That would be like going into a gay bar if you're straight and hoping to get lucky."
"What? I'm not gay."
"I didn't say..." "Oh, never mind." In spite of the fact that this man is a Neanderthal, Jenna herself seems fascinated.
"So, let's say there's a ghost attached to me. Would it watch me when I shower?"
"I doubt it. They were alive once. They understand privacy."
"Then what's the fun in being a ghost?"
Virgil says under his breath. We step over the chain at the gate, moving with unspoken agreement into the sanctuary. "I didn't say it was fun. Most of the ghosts I've met haven't been too happy. They feel like they've left something unfinished, or they were so busy looking into glory holes in their last life, they have to get their act together before they move on to whatever comes next."
"You're telling me the peeping Tom I arrested in the gas station bathroom automatically develops a conscience in the afterlife? Seems a little convenient."
I look back over my shoulder. "There's a conflict between body and soul sometimes. That friction is free will. Your guy probably didn't come to Earth to spy on folks in a gas station bathroom, but somehow ego or narcissism or some other garbage happened to him in his life while he was here. So even though his soul might have been telling him not to look through that hole, his body was saying tough luck." I push through some tall grass, untangling a reed that has gotten snared in the fringe of my poncho. "It's like that for drug addicts, too. Or alcoholics." Virgil abruptly turns.
"I'm going this way."
"Actually," I say, pointing in the opposite direction, "I'm getting the feeling we should go this way." I am not really getting that feeling at all. It's just that Virgil seems like such an ass that if he says black, I'm determined to say white right now. He's already judged and hanged me, which leads me to believe he knows exactly who I am and can remember Senator McCoy's boy. In fact, if I weren't so completely convinced that there is a reason I have to be with Jenna at this moment, I would bushwhack back to my car and drive the hell home.
Serenity?
Jenna asks, because she's had the good sense to follow me.
What you said about the body and the soul back there, is that true for anyone who does bad things?
I glance at Jenna. Something tells me that isn't a philosophical question.
Virgil thinks the reason my mother disappeared was because she was the one who killed the caregiver at the sanctuary. I thought it was an accident. That's what the police said back then, anyway. But I guess there were some questions Virgil never got answered, and my mother up and left before he got the chance to ask them.
Jenna shakes her head.
The medical report said blunt force trauma from trampling was the cause of death. But I mean, what if it was just blunt force trauma caused by a person, and then the elephant trampled the body once it was dead? Can you even tell the difference?
I didn't know. That was a question for Virgil, if we ever found each other in the woods again. But it didn't surprise me that a woman who loved elephants as much as Jenna's mother had might have one of her animals trying to cover up for her. That rainbow bridge pet lovers always talk about, it's there. I'd occasionally been told by those who'd crossed over that the person waiting for them on the other side was not a person at all, but a dog, a horse, once even a pet tarantula. Assuming that the death of the caregiver at this sanctuary wasn't an accident, that Alice might still be alive and on the run, it would explain why I hadn't gotten the clear sense that she was a spirit trying to contact her daughter. On the other hand, that wasn't the only reason why.
You still want to find your mother, if it means learning she committed murder? Yeah, because then at least I'd know that she's still alive.
Jenna sinks down into the grass. It's nearly as high as the crown of her head.
You said you'd tell me if you knew she had passed, and you still haven't said she's dead.
Well, I certainly haven't heard from her spirit yet, I agree. I don't clarify that the reason might be not because she's alive, but rather because I'm a hack. Jenna starts plucking tufts of grass and sprinkling them over her bare knees.
Does it get to you? She asks. People like Virgil thinking you're crazy?
I've been called worse. And besides, neither one of us is going to know who's right until we're both dead. She considers this.
I have this math teacher, Mr. Allen. He said that when you're a point, all you see is the point. When you're a line, all you see is the line and the point. When you're in three dimensions, you see three dimensions and lines and points. Just because we can't see a fourth dimension doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means we haven't reached it yet.
You, I say, are wise beyond your years, girl. Jenna ducks her head.
Those ghosts you met before, how long do they stick around?
It varies. Once they get their closure, they usually move on. I know what she's asking and why. It's the one myth about the afterlife that I hate debunking. People always think they're going to be reunited with their loved ones for eternity once they die. Let me tell you, it doesn't work that way. The afterlife isn't just a continuation of this one. You and your beloved dead husband don't pick up where you left off, doing the crossword at the kitchen table, or arguing over who finished the milk. Maybe in some cases it's possible, but just as often as not, your husband might have moved on, graduating to a different level of soul. Or maybe you're the one who's more spiritually evolved, and you'll bypass him while he's still figuring out how to leave this life behind. When my clients used to come to me, All they wanted to hear from a loved one who had passed was, "I will be waiting when you get here." 9 times out of 10, what they got instead was, "You won't be seeing me again." The girl looks sunken, small. "Jenna," I lie, "if your mother was dead, I would know." I had thought I was going to hell because I was making a living by scamming clients who thought I still had a gift. But clearly, today, I am guaranteeing myself a front-row seat at Lucifer's one-man show by making this child believe in me when I cannot even believe in myself.
"Oh, hey, are you two done with your picnic? Or should I keep traipsing around here looking for a needle in a haystack?"
"No, correction," Virgil says.
"Not a needle. A needle's useful."
He towers over us with his hands on his hips, scowling. Maybe I'm not supposed to just be here for Jenna. Maybe I'm supposed to be here for Virgil Stanhope, too. I get to my feet and try to push away the tsunami of negativity rolling off him.
"Maybe if you opened yourself up to the possibility, you'd find something unexpected." "Thanks, Gandhi. But I prefer to deal in legitimate facts, not woo-woo mumbo-jumbo."
"That woo-woo mumbo-jumbo won me 3 Emmys, I point out. "And don't you think we're all a little psychic? Haven't you ever thought about a friend you haven't seen in forever, and then he calls, out of the blue?"
"No,"
Virgil says flatly.
"Of course, you don't have any friends. What about when you're driving down the road with your GPS on and you think, 'I'm going to take a left,' and sure enough, that's what the GPS tells you to do next?"
He laughs.
"So being psychic is a matter of probability. You have a 50-50 chance of being right."
"You've never had an inner voice? A gut reaction? Intuition?" Virgil grins.
"Want to guess what my intuition's telling me right now?"
I throw up my hands. "I quit," I say to Jenna. "I don't know why you thought I'd be the right person to..."
"I recognize this."
Virgil starts striking through the reeds with purpose, and Jenna and I both follow.
"There used to be a really big tree, but see how it got split by lightning? And there's a pond over there," he says, gesturing.
He tries to orient himself by pivoting a few times before walking about 100 yards to the north. There, he moves in concentric, widening circles, stepping gingerly until the ground sinks beneath his shoe. Triumphantly, Virgil leans down and starts pulling away fallen branches and spongy moss, revealing a deep hole.
"This is where we found the body."
"Who was trampled?" Jenna says pointedly. I take a step back, not wanting to get in the middle of this drama, and that's when I see something winking at me, half buried in the thicket of moss that Virgil overturned. I lean down and pull out a chain, its clasp intact, with a tiny pendant still dangling, a pebble, polished to the highest gloss. Another sign. "I hear you," I think, to whoever is beyond that wall of silence, and let the necklace pool in the valley of my palm.
"Look at this. Maybe it belonged to the victim?"
Jenna's face drains of color.
"That was my mom's. And she never, ever took it off."
When I meet a non-believer, and sugar, let me tell you, they seem to be attracted to me like bees to nectar, I bring up Thomas Edison. There isn't a person on this planet who wouldn't say he was the epitome of a scientist, that his mathematical mind allowed him to create the phonograph, the light bulb, the motion picture camera, and projector. We know he was a free thinker who said there was no supreme being. We know he held 1,093 patents. We also know that before he passed, he was in the process of inventing a machine to talk to the dead. The height of the Industrial Revolution was also the height of the spiritualist movement.
The fact that Edison was a supporter of the mechanical breakthroughs in the physical world doesn't mean he wasn't equally entranced by the metaphysical. If mediums could do it via seance, he reasoned, surely a machine calibrated with great care could communicate with those on the other side. He didn't talk much about this intended invention. Maybe he was afraid of his concept being stolen. Maybe he had not come up with a specific design. He told Scientific American magazine that the machine would be in the nature of a valve, meaning that, with the slightest effort from the other side, some wire might be tripped, some bell might be rung, some proof might be had. Can I tell you that Edison believed in the afterlife? Well, although he was quoted as saying that life wasn't destructible, he never came back to tell me so personally. Can I tell you he wasn't trying to debunk spiritualism? Not entirely. But it is equally possible that he wanted to apply a scientist's brain to a field that was hard to quantify. It is equally possible that he was trying to justify what I used to do for a living by giving cold, hard evidence. I also know that Edison believed the moment between being awake and being asleep was a veil. And it was in that moment that we were most connected to our higher selves. He would set pie tins out on the floor beside each arm of his easy chair and take a nap. Holding a big ball bearing in each hand, he'd nod off until the metal struck metal. He'd write down whatever he was seeing, thinking, imagining at that moment. He became pretty proficient at maintaining that in-between state. Maybe he was trying to channel his creativity. Or maybe he was trying to channel, well, spirits. After Edison's death, no prototypes or papers were found that suggested he'd started work on his machine to talk to the dead. I suppose that means the folks in charge of his estate were embarrassed by his spiritualist leanings, or they didn't want that to be the memory left behind of a great scientist. Seems to me, though, that Thomas Edison got the last laugh, because at his home in Fort Myers, Florida, there's a life-size statue of him in the parking lot, and in his hand, he's holding that ball bearing. I am having the sense of a male presence, although, if I'm going to be honest, that might just be a sinus headache coming on. Of course you're sensing a guy, Virgil says, balling up the aluminum foil that housed his chili dog. I have never seen a human being eat the way this man eats. The terms that come to mind are giant squid and wet vac.
Who else would give a chick a necklace?
Are you always this rude? He picks off one of my French fries.
For you, I'm making a special exception.
You still hungry? I ask. How about I serve up a steaming platter of I told you so? Virgil scowls.
Why? Because you tripped over a piece of jewelry?
Well, what did you find?
The pimply boy in the corrugated metal trailer who served up our hot dogs is watching this exchange.
What?
I bark at him.
Have you never seen people argue? He's probably never seen someone with pink hair,
Virgil murmurs.
At least I still have hair, I point out.
That, at least, hits him where it hurts. He runs a hand over his nearly buzzed cut.
This is badass, he says.
You just keep telling yourself that.
I glimpse the teen hot dog vendor from the corner of my eye again, staring. Part of me wants to believe that he's drawn to the spectacle of the human Hoover polishing off the rest of my lunch. But there's a niggling thought in my head that maybe he recognizes me as the celebrity I used to be.
Don't you have some ketchup bottles to fill?
I snap, and he shrinks back from the window. We are sitting outside in a park, eating the hot dogs I bought after Virgil realized he didn't have a dime on him.
It's my father,
Jenna says over a mouthful of her tofu dog. She is wearing the necklace now. It dangles over her t-shirt.
That's who gave it to my mother. I was there.
I remember.
Great, you remember your mother getting a rock on a chain, but not what happened the night she vanished,
Virgil says. Try holding it, Jenna, I suggest. When I used to get called in for kidnappings, the way I got my best leads was to touch something that had belonged to the missing child.
Spoken like a bitch, Virgil says.
I beg your pardon? He looks up, all innocence.
Female dog, right? Isn't that how bloodhounds track, too?
Ignoring him, I watch Jenna curl the necklace into her fist, squeeze her eyes shut.
Nothing,
she says after a moment. It'll come, I promise, when you least expect it. You've got a lot of natural ability, I can tell. I bet you'll remember something important when you're brushing your teeth tonight. This is not necessarily true, of course. I've been waiting for years now, and I'm as dry as a bar in Salt Lake City.
She's not the only one who could use that to jog a memory,
Virgil says, thinking out loud.
Maybe the guy who gave it to Alice could tell us something.
Jenna's head snaps up.
My father? He can't even remember my name half the time.
I pat her arm. No need to be embarrassed about the sins of the fathers. My daddy was a drag queen.
What's wrong with that? Jenna asks.
Nothing, but he happened to be a very bad drag queen.
Well, my father's in an institution, Jenna says.
I look at Virgil over her head.
Ah.
Far as I know, Virgil says, no one ever went back to talk to your father after your mom disappeared. Maybe it's worth a try.
I've done enough cold reading to be able to tell when a person is not being transparent, and right now, Virgil Stanhope is lying like a rug. I don't know what his game is, or what he hopes to get out of Thomas Metcalf, but I'm not letting Jenna go with him alone. Even if I swore, I'd never go back into a psychiatric facility. After the incident with the senator, I had a run of dark days. There was a lot of vodka involved, and some prescription medication. My manager at the time was the one who suggested I take a vacation, and by vacation, she meant a little sojourn at a psych ward. It was incredibly discreet, the kind of place that celebrities go to refresh, which is Hollywood speak for get your stomach pumped, dry out, or have ECT. I was there for 30 days, long enough to know I would never let myself get that low again if it meant returning. My roommate was a pretty little thing who was the daughter of a famous hip-hop artist. Gita had shaved off all her hair and had a line of piercings down the curve of her spine, linked by a thin platinum chain, which made me wonder how she slept on her back. She talked to an invisible posse that was absolutely real to her. When one of those imaginary people apparently came after her with a knife, she had run into traffic and gotten hit by a taxi. She was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. At the time I lived with her, she believed that she was being controlled by aliens through cell phones. Every time someone tried to send a text, Gita went ballistic. One night, Gita started rocking back and forth in her bed, saying, "I'm gonna get struck by lightning! I'm gonna get struck by lightning!" It was a clear summer night, mind you, but she wouldn't stop. She kept this up, and an hour later, when a thunderstorm cell came sweeping through the area, she started to scream and rip at her own skin. A nurse came in, trying to calm her down. "Honey," she said, "the thunder and the lightning are outside. You're safe in here." Gita turned to her, and in that one moment, I saw nothing but clarity in her eyes. "You know nothing," she whispered. There was a drum roll of thunder, and suddenly the window shattered. A neon arc of lightning staggered in, seared the rug, and burned a hole the size of a fist into the mattress beside Gita, who started rocking harder. "I told you I was going to get struck by lightning," she said. "I told you I was going to get struck by lightning." I tell you this story by way of explanation. The people we define as crazy just might be more sane than you and me.
My father's not going to be helpful, Jenna insists. We shouldn't even bother.
Again, my cold reading skills shine. The way she cuts her eyes to the left like that. The way she is now chewing on her fingernail. Jenna's lying, too. Why?
Jenna,
I ask, can you run to the car and see if I left my sunglasses in there? She gets up, more than happy to escape this conversation.
All right.
I wait for Virgil to meet my gaze. I don't know what you're up to, but I don't trust you.
Excellent. Then we feel exactly the same way about each other.
What are you not telling her?
He hesitates, deciding whether or not to trust me, I'm sure.
The night the caregiver was found dead, Thomas Metcalf was nervous, antsy. It could have been because his wife and daughter were missing at the time. And it could have been because he was already showing signs of a breakdown. But it also could have been a guilty conscience.
I lean back, crossing my arms.
You think Thomas is a suspect. You think Alice is a suspect. Seems to me you think everyone's to blame except yourself, for saying in the first place that the death was an accident.
Virgil looks up at me.
I think Thomas Metcalf might have been abusing his wife.
That's a damn good reason to run away, I say, thinking out loud.
So you want to meet with him and try to get a reaction out of him?
When Virgil shrugs, I know I'm right. Did you ever consider what that might do to Jenna? She already thinks her mother abandoned her. You're going to take off her rose-colored glasses and show her that her father was a bastard, too? He shifts.
She should have thought of that before she hired me.
You're really an ass.
That's what I get paid for.
Then for all intents and purposes, you ought to be in a different tax bracket.
I narrow my gaze. You and I know you're not getting rich off this case. So what do you get out of it?
The truth.
For Jenna? I ask. Or for you? Because you were too lazy to find it out 10 years ago.
A muscle ticks in his jaw. For a second, I think I've crossed the line. That he's going to get up and storm off. Before he can, though, Jenna reappears.
No sunglasses, she says.
She is still holding the stone, still fastened around her neck. I know that some neurologists think that autistic kids have brain synapses so close together and firing in such quick succession that they cause hyper-awareness, that one of the reasons children on the spectrum rock or stim is to help them focus, instead of having all sensations bombard them at once. I think clairvoyance isn't really all that much different. In all probability, neither is mental illness. I asked Gita once about her imaginary friends.
Imaginary? She repeated, as if I were the one who was crazy, for not seeing them.
And here's the kicker. I understood what she was talking about. Because I've been there. If you notice someone talking to a person you can't see, she may be a paranoid schizophrenic. But she may also just be psychic. The fact that you can't see the other half of the conversation doesn't mean it's not truly happening. That's the other reason I don't particularly want to visit Thomas Metcalf in a psychiatric facility. I just may be coming face to face with people who can't control a natural gift I'd kill to have once again.
You know how to get to the institution? Virgil asks.
Really, Jenna says, it's really not such a great idea to visit my dad. He doesn't always react well to people he doesn't know.
I thought you said he doesn't even recognize you sometimes. So who's to say we're not just old friends he's forgotten?
I see Jenna trying to work through Virgil's logic, deciding if she should be protecting her father or trying to take advantage of his weak defenses.
He's right, I say.
Virgil and Jenna are both shocked by my statement.
You agree with him?
Jenna asks. I nod.
If your dad has anything to contribute about why your mother left that night, it might point us in the right direction.
It's up to you, Virgil says,
noncommittal. After a long moment, Jenna says, "The truth is, my mother's all he ever talks about. How they met, what she looked like, when he knew he was going to ask her to get married." She bites her lower lip. "The reason I said I didn't want you to go to the institution is because I didn't want to share that with you, with anyone. It's like the only connection I have with my dad. He's the one person who misses her as much as I do."
When the universe calls, you don't place it on hold. There is a reason I keep circling back to this girl. It's either because of her gravitational pull or because she's a drain I'm bound to be sucked down. I offer my brightest smile. "Sugar," I say, "I'm a sucker for a good love story."
Alice. The matriarch had died. It was Mabo who had slipped to the back of her herd yesterday, her movements laborious and jerky before she sank down on her front knees and then toppled over. I had been up for 36 straight hours observing. I noted how Mabo's herd, her daughter Onalena, who was her closest companion, had tried to lift her mother with her tusks and had managed to prop her on her feet only to have Mabo fall over for good. How her trunk had reached toward Onalena one last time before unfurling on the ground like a skein of ribbon. How Onalena and the others in the herd had made sounds of distress, had tried to prod their leader with their trunks and their bodies, pushing and pulling at Mabo's corpse. After 6 hours, the herd left the body, but almost immediately, another elephant approached. I thought it was a trailing member of Mabo's herd, but recognized the notched triangle on the left ear and the freckled feet of Setunia, the matriarch of a different, smaller herd. Setunia and Mabo were not related, but as Setunia approached, she too got quieter, softer in her movements. Her head bowed, her ears drooped. She touched Mabo's body with her trunk. She lifted her left rear foot and held it above Mabo's body. Then she stepped over Mabo so that her front legs and back legs straddled the fallen elephant. She began to sway back and forth. I timed this for 6 minutes. It felt like a dance, though there was no music. A silent dirge. What did it mean? Why was an elephant not related to Mabo so profoundly affected by her death? It had been 2 months since the death of Kenosi, the young bull who'd been caught in the snare. 2 months since I'd officially narrowed the focus of my postdoctoral work. While other colleagues working at the game reserve were studying the migration patterns of Thule black elephants and how they affected the ecosystem, or the effects of drought on the reproductive rate of elephants, or must and male seasonality, my science was cognitive. It could not be measured with a geographic tracking device. It was not in the DNA. No matter how many times I recorded instances of elephants touching another elephant's skull, or returning to the site where a former herd member died, the moment I interpreted that as grief, I was crossing a line animal researchers were not supposed to cross. I was attributing emotion to a non-human creature. If anyone had ever asked me to defend my work, here's what I would have said. The more complex a behavior is, the more rigorous and complicated the science behind it. Math, chemistry, that's the easy stuff. Closed models with discrete answers. To understand behavior, human or elephant, the systems are far more complex, which is why the science behind them must be that much more intricate. But no one ever asked. I'm pretty sure my boss, Grant, thought this was a phase I was going through, and that sooner or later I'd get back to science instead of elephant cognition. I had seen elephants die before, but this was the first time since I'd changed my research focus. I wanted every last detail to be noted. I wanted to make sure I didn't overlook anything as too mundane. Any action that I might learn later was critical to the way elephants mourn. To that end, I stayed there, sacrificing sleep. I marked down which elephants came to visit, identifying them by their tusks, their tail hair, the marks on their bodies, and sometimes even the veins on their ears, which had patterns as unique as our own thumbprints. I catalogued how much time they spent touching Mabo, where they explored. I wrote down when they left the body and if they returned. I catalogued the other animals, impala and one giraffe, that passed through the vicinity unaware that a matriarch had fallen. But mostly, I stayed because I wanted to know if Onalena would come back. It took her nearly 10 hours to return, and when she did, it was twilight, and her herd was off in the distance. She stood quietly beside her mother's corpse as night fell, immediate as a guillotine. Every now and then she would vocalize, to be answered by rumbles from the northeast, as if she needed to check in with her sisters and to remind them she was still here. Onalena hadn't moved in the past hour, which is probably why I was so startled by the arrival of a Land Rover, the headlights slicing through the dark. It startled Onalena, too, and she backed away from her dead mother, her ears flapping in threat. "There you are," Anya said as she pulled her vehicle closer. She was another elephant researcher, who was studying how migratory routes had changed because of poaching. "You didn't answer your walkie-talkie." I turned the volume down. "I didn't want to disturb her," I said, nodding toward the nervous elephant. "Well, Grant needs you to do something."
"Now?"
My boss had been less than encouraging when I told him about shifting my focus to elephant grief. He hardly talked to me at all now. Did this mean he was coming around? Anya looked at Mabo's body. "When did it happen?"
"Almost 24 hours ago."
"Have you told the Rangers yet?"
I shook my head. "I would, of course. They'd come down and cut the tusks off Mabo to discourage poachers. But I thought, for a few more hours at least, her herd deserved to have time to grieve."
"When should I tell Grant to expect you?" Anya asked.
"Soon," I said.
Anya's vehicle slipped into the bush, becoming a tiny pinprick of light in the inky distance, like a firefly. Onalena blew out, a huffing sound. She slipped her trunk into her mother's mouth. Before I could even record that behavior, a hyena trotted into the space in front of Mabo. The spotlight I had on the scene caught the bright white incisors as he opened his jaws. Onalena rumbled. She reached out her trunk, which seemed too far from the hyena to do damage. But African elephants have an extra foot or so of trunk length that, like an accordion, can punch out at you when you least expect it. She popped that hyena so hard it went rolling away from Mabo's corpse, whimpering. Onalena turned her heavy head toward me. She was secreting from her temporal glands deep gray streaks.
"You're going to have to let her go," I said out loud, but I am not sure which one of us I was trying to convince.
I woke with a start when I felt the sun on my face, the first shards of daylight. My first thought was that Grant was going to kill me. My second thought was that Onalena was gone. In her place were two lionesses, tearing at Mabo's hindquarters.
Above, a vulture swam through the sky in a figure eight, awaiting its turn. I didn't want to go back to camp. I wanted to sit by Umabo's corpse to see if any other elephants would continue to pay their respects. I wanted to find Onalena and see what she was doing now, how the herd was behaving, who was the new de facto matriarch. I wanted to know if she could turn grief off like a faucet, or if she still missed her mother. How long it took for that feeling to pass. Grant was punishing me, plain and simple. Out of all the colleagues that my boss could have picked to babysit some New England asshole that was coming here for a week's visit, he chose me. "Grant," I said, "it's not every day we lose a matriarch. You have to recognize how critical this is to my research." He looked up from his desk. "The elephant's still going to be dead a week from now." If my research wouldn't sway Grant, maybe my schedule would. "But I'm already supposed to take Owen out today," I told him. Owen was the bush vet. We were collaring a matriarch for a new study that was being done by a research team from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Or, in other words, I am busy. Grant looked up at me. "Fantastic," he said. "I'm sure this fellow would love to see you do the collaring." And so I found myself sitting at the entrance of the game reserve, waiting for Thomas Metcalf of Boone, New Hampshire, to arrive. It was always a hassle when visitors came. Sometimes they were the fat cats who sponsored a caller for GPS monitoring and wanted to come with their wives and their business buddies to play the politically correct version of the Great White Hunter game. Instead of killing elephants, they watched a vet dart one so it could be collared and then toasted their magnanimousness with G&T sundowners. Sometimes it was a trainer from a zoo or a circus, and when that was the case, they were almost always idiots. The last guy I'd had to squire around in my Land Rover for 2 days was a keeper at the Philadelphia Zoo. And when we saw a 6-year-old bull secreting from its temporal glands, he insisted the baby was coming into must. No matter how I argued with him, I mean, really? A 6-year-old male just cannot come into must. He assured me that he was right. I'll admit, when Thomas Metcalf pried himself out of the African taxi, which is an experience in and of itself if you haven't been in one before, he did not look the way I expected. He was about my age, with small round glasses that steamed up when he stepped into the humidity so that he fumbled to grab the handle of his suitcase. He looked me over from my messy ponytail to my pink Converse sneakers. "Are you George?" he said. "Do I look like a George?" George was one of my colleagues, a student none of us ever thought would finish his PhD. In other words, the butt of all the jokes. That is, until I started studying elephant grief. "No, I mean, I'm sorry. I was expecting someone else."
"Sorry to disappoint you," I said. "I'm Alice. Welcome to the Northern Thule Block." I led him to the Land Rover, and we started winding along the unmarked, dusty paths that looped through the reserve. As we rolled along, I recited the spiel we give visitors. "The first elephants were recorded here in roughly AD 700. In the late 1800s, when guns were supplied to local chiefs, it affected the elephant population dramatically. By the time the great white hunters arrived, the elephants were almost gone. It wasn't until the game reserve was founded that the numbers increased. Our research staff is in the field 7 days a week," I said. "Although we are all involved in different research projects, we also take care of core monitoring, observing the breeding herds and their associations, identifying the individuals in each, tracking their activity and their habitat, determining home range,
doing census once a month, recording births and deaths, estrus and must, collecting data on bull elephants, recording rainfall. How many elephants do you have here?
About 1,400, I said. Not to mention leopard, lion, cheetah.
I can't imagine. I have 6 elephants, and it's hard enough to figure out who's who if you haven't been with them day in and day out.
I had grown up in New England, and I knew that the odds of there being wild elephants there were about as high as me spontaneously growing another arm. Which meant this guy ran either a zoo or a circus, neither of which I endorsed. When trainers tell you that the behaviors taught to elephants are things they'd do in the wild, they're lying. In the wild, elephants do not stand on their hind legs or walk grabbing each other's tails or skip around in a ring. In the wild, elephants are always only a few yards away from another elephant. They are constantly stroking and rubbing and checking in with each other. The whole relationship between humans and elephants in captivity is about exploitation. As if I didn't already dislike Thomas Metcalf for being my punishment, I now disliked him on principle. "So," he said, "what do you do here?" God save me from tourists. "I'm the local Mary Kay cosmetics sales girl."
"I meant, what research do you do?"
I glanced at him from the corner of my eye. There was no reason for me to feel defensive toward a man I had met a minute ago, a man whose knowledge of elephants was far less comprehensive than mine. And yet I was so used to the raised eyebrows when I talked about my new research that I had become accustomed to not talking about it. I was saved from replying by a waterfall of horns and hooves bolting across the path. I grabbed the steering wheel and braked at the last moment. "You'd better hang on," I suggested.
"They're amazing,"
Thomas gasped, and I tried not to roll my eyes. When you live here, you get jaded. To tourists, everything is new, worth slowing down for, an adventure. Yes, that's a giraffe. Yes, it's extraordinary, but not after you've seen one for the 700th time.
"Are they antelope?"
"They're impala, but we call them McDonald's." Thomas pointed to the rump of one animal, now grazing.
"Because of the markings?"
"Impala have 2 black lines running down each hind leg, and another line streaking their stub tail, which does look a little like the golden arches. But their nickname comes from being the most prevalent meal in the bush for predators." "Because over 1 billion have been served," I said. "There is a difference between the romance of Africa and the reality of it. Tourists who come on safari excited to see a kill, who are then lucky enough to witness a lioness taking down its prey, often become quiet and queasy." I watched Thomas's face go pale.
"Well, Toto," I said, "guess you're not in New Hampshire anymore."
As we waited at the main camp for Owen, the bush vet, I told Thomas the rules of safari. "Don't get out of the vehicle. Don't stand up in the vehicle. The animals see us as one big entity, and if you separate yourself from that profile, you're in trouble."
"Sorry to keep you. There was a rhino relocation that didn't go as smoothly as I hoped."
Owen Dunkirk came hurrying out, carrying a bag and his rifle. Owen was a bear of a man who preferred to dart from a vehicle rather than a helicopter. We used to be on good terms until I switched my focus of field work. Owen was old school. He believed in evidence and statistics. I might as well have said I was using a research grant to study voodoo or prove the existence of unicorns.
"Thomas," I said, "this is Owen, our vet. Owen, this is Thomas Metcalf. He's visiting for a few days." "You sure you're still up to this, Alice?" Owen said.
Maybe you've forgotten how to call her since you've been writing elephant eulogies and whatnot.
I ignored his jab and the strange look Thomas met